Let's start today's podcast with discussing the joy of ginger shots. For two people who don't drink booze, ginger shot is the most invigorating thing, isn't it, Brian?
It's sort of like a tequila shot, but obviously without the tequila and without the hangover. And so it's like all the woof, the woof, that yeah. sounded like it doesn't turn you into a dog, but all the whoop, whoop without any of the...
Yes, just noises.
But there's no blacking out.
Do you know what? It's so very funny. My husband always teases me because he says, you just make noises instead of words sometimes. And you're somebody who speaks for a living. But noises work.
Should this podcast just be yeah. a selection okay. of strange all right. noises?
And let's start with just some, yeah. You know exactly what I said. I hope you do.
I do. We don't need to speak. We could just sit here quietly for an hour and I'd know exactly what you were saying, Gabby.
But I know you know what I'm thinking as well, and I would know what you're thinking. So we've known each other quite a while now, and you are without a doubt one of my favourite people. And and your new book is so special. Oh, it's sort of come on so much from the last one. It's even more intimate, if it can be, than your other ones.
Oh, wow, thanks.
Is it meant... Did you want to do that?
I don't know. I feel like I can only write what I can write at the at the time. But I suppose I wanted to show that recovery isn't linear. And I suppose with all of my books, it's kind of a snapshot of where I am at that moment in time, but also so I guess I've come, I don't know, I it's really difficult. It came from such a place of darkness and such a place of like lacking any confidence. Everything I'd built up over many decades had sort of been pulled out of me. It was like a rug had been pulled out from underneath me. And so it sort of I find that when I write, when I go into the darkness, it's sort of, oh, I don't know, I should have just made a selection of strange sounds, and that would have made more sense than what I was saying.
Just to us. No, yeah. The whole thing made total sense.
I guess I get more, I feel like life gets better the older I get, and the more well I get, and the more I experience, life does just get better and better, you know? So maybe I get better.
So life getting better. Now, most people say that, but then there is something very odd that happens. So growing up, I'm never going to be a grown up, but growing older and life carrying on for you, you learn things about yourself. And I don't think, you know, the expression of older and wiser, I don't know if there's any wiser, but you learn stuff about yourself. And yet from the outside, people have a different view of you as you get older and better. Whereas from inside you, you feel better. God, did that make sense? I don't think it did. That was waffle, but I know what
it makes sense to me, Gabby. But also, I think as I get older, so life doesn't get better and better in that it's all rainbows unicorns and fluffy
and
puppies and you know, and just brilliant thing after brilliant thing, which is how I measured a good life when I was younger. I was like, oh, as long as I keep hitting all of these metrics and getting these things in my life, then life will be good. Life gets better in that I'm much more able to cope when it's bad. So I have had, you know, I realise I had this notion of happiness, which was like a destination, you know, whereas actually I realise it's a bit like, I guess what, I have no idea what it must be like to be an Olympic athlete, but, you know, you go for the gold and then you've got to start training all over again for the next, you know, the next thing. So, and I guess that's what I realise life is, you know, it's a kind of series of nice moments laced together with quite tough stuff. But I'm so much better at dealing with the tough stuff. You know,
and how did you deal with it, and how do you deal with it? So, what's the major difference?
So, I used to deal with it with alcohol and drugs.
Yeah,
that's the truth. You know? So, I'm in recovery. I don't drink anymore, but that was the only way I knew how to deal with bad feelings and bad shit, even though it created more bad shit, you know. So that was how I, and that's probably, I think, how a lot of people deal with life. You know, in the UK, we kind of teach, you know, we don't really teach people, we're like, let's teach kids how to be happy, but let's not teach them how to be sad, which is a bit of a waste because we are going to be sad. And it's much better if we can sort of learn, let's teach kids how to be happy without, teach kids how to be sad without, like, picking up a drink to kind of numb it, you know?
The Friday night thing is a classic thing. Worst awful, awful week, I'll just go and get drunk.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a bloody good way of numbing it. And, you know, and it got me, you know, it got, you know, it was my saviour, really, alcohol, because I don't think I would have been able to crawl out of my bedroom. You know, I was in such deep depressions, you know, and I say that just because I was, you know, I was a deeply shy, I felt very other as a child, and, you know, alcohol gave me the courage to get out and do things and to weather storms. You know, it worked until it stopped working, right? So that was how I used to deal with stuff. Now I don't drink and I have to sit and go through the shit, which is much harder, but it does tend to pass much quicker then.
That's interesting. So without the alcohol, you get through it quicker.
Yeah. So, like, there's a phrase, isn't there, which is like, when you're going through hell, keep going. And I think I kept sort of trying to go, oh, no, I'll just take a little detour around. But then you just get stuck. You're trying to take the scenic route around hell. You're just stuck in it for a hell of a lot longer.
So for you now, I mean, it's interesting because you know, in this book, you talk about how dark you felt and you suffer with depression. You're so open about all of the things, and your OCD and menopause. All of this is covered in the book. How do you know when you're going there? Do you know when that slide is happening?
No, I don't. I'm like, this is the thing that I find so incredible with human brains, is that we can know all of this stuff about mental illness, about depression, about anxiety, and we can say it to other people. Like, I can tell people to their blue in their face, like, you're doing really well, you know, you're not your thoughts, you're just the person that hears them. And yet when I'm in it, it's, you know, and this is when we're in it ourselves, we're in it. So it's very difficult, and also very difficult to know that we're in it, because, you know, for a long time my brain was like, you're not depressed, you're just being a dickhead.
It doesn't say that anymore.
No, not at the moment, but it might do again. But it's one. But the thing is, I'm much more, you know, I recognize it a lot quicker. I may not recognize it going in, but, you know, we keep trying. But I think that thing of depression, you know, your brain saying you're not depressed, you're just a dickhead, is in itself a really key symptom of depression. And yet, of course, when you're in it, that voice is so strong, it's very hard not to believe it. So I feel, so I don't always see, but I do tend to pull myself out of it in a healthier way, I would say. And I'm less prone to shaming myself for ending up in that hole. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's fantastic to hear.
So I, you know, Mad Woman, the book, is a lot of the book is about realizing I got sober. I was 2.5 years sober when the pandemic began, and I was just so relieved I was sober and I wasn't drinking, because I thought, oh my goodness, with all these lockdowns and then the sun shining and then this weirdness, if I was still drinking, I would have just drunk myself into an early grave if I had even lived that long, right? And I was so relieved that I was sober that I kind of hadn't realized that I had fallen headfirst into this other addiction, which was food. And it took me a long time. It took me about, I don't know, 10 months to realize I had developed binge eating disorder. I didn't even know it was binge eating. I didn't even know binge eating disorder was a thing. I just thought I was binging, but because I wasn't purging and I had suffered from bulimia in my 20s, that I was okay. But of course, it wasn't okay. But I realized, ooh, there's another faulty coping mechanism that my brain has used to try and numb myself out. Like, that binge eating disorder, like alcoholism, was a way of trying to take the scenic route around hell. Do you know what I mean? And I went, oh no. And the moment that you know, and I got help, and it took a long time, and it's, you know, recovery is not linear, you know, change isn't linear, it's, but the point was, I kind of noticed it and I sat down and I went through the stuff I had to go through. And yeah, so I don't know, like life does get better and better. And now I'm, you know, and I can see, I was thinking about this morning because I'm training for this crazy
running challenge. From, you're running the Brighton Marathon and then you're running from Brighton to London to do the London Marathon.
And then I'm going to do the London Marathon. And the
without stopping?
Well, I'll stop and sleep and things like that.
No.
No, it's over. So the Brighton Marathon is 2 weeks before the London Marathon.
Yeah.
So I'm going to, over 2 weeks, run a little bit every day. And the idea is to get, is to show people that exercise is for everyone. Because yeah. I'm a larger lady, Gabby. You know, I'm a size 18 to 20 or whatever. But I love exercise. It's completely been transformative for my mental health. Someone
Isn't
the other day was like, "Are you sure you haven't just cross addicted to exercise?" And I was like, "No, that it's not. It's just not the same thing. I genuinely love it, but I don't love it so much that I have to get out of bed in the morning and do it." But anyway, so I wanted to show that you know, for me, when I started to exercise for the way it made me feel rather than the way it made me look, everything was transformed. And I'm also doing it to raise money for Mental Health Mates, which is this incredible peer support group that I kind of accidentally set up nearly 10 years ago, which is now...
Is it 10 years?
About 8 years, but like, let's round it up.
Okay. I'm happy to round it up.
Almost 10 years.
It's almost 20 years.
It's almost 100 years since I set up Mental Health Mates.
God, you look good on the exercise. Wow.
But Mental Health Mates, so it's in 150 cities around the UK, and it's put you know, simply, it's a way for people with mental health issues to get outside in some fresh air and move. You don't have to run, it's walks. But with other people who get it, who are going through or have gone through the same thing, because we know exercise is good for your head. And we know getting out of your head in that is one of the best ways, in nature is one of the best ways to do it. So people all over the country run Mental Health Mates walks, and I want to kind of support them by raising money. But so I've gone through getting back to the point. I can tell this, we're going to do
I do this all the time, so sorry.
So yeah, I've been training for quite some time, and the last 2 weeks have been really hard, probably because I've got a book out. I've had a book out as well, and I've been like hitting the promo trail hard. So I feel like I'm Taylor Swift or something. But yet also trying to train, and I've been a bit injured, and it's been like really dark. And there have been times where I've thought, I'm not going to be able to do this.
What's your injury? Apart from, so I want to ask you about your heart as well. Mm. But have you got injuries on top of that?
I've got like,
what have you done?
It was nothing big, a slightly pulled abductor, which is, but I was like, oh no. And I've had to take some time off, and it was really dark. And then yesterday I went and ran 10 miles.
Just like that.
And
that's good. Just listen to yourself. How, okay. And I don't, obviously it sounds like I mean literal, but I ran 10 miles.
I ran 10 miles.
And then that's not nothing.
And then I felt, no, of course it was, but I felt quite creaky afterwards. And this morning I woke up and I had to run again, according to my training plan. And I thought, I can't do it. And then I went, you can do it, Bryony. Even if you have to just walk, you can do it. And I got up and I was flying. I literally thought, oh my God, I'm like Mo Farah. I probably didn't look like that, but I don't care because I felt like it. And I got back and I was high as a kite. And I kind of was like, oh, you had to go through that little dark glitch to, you know, a little bit of an injury. And then you rest and you recover and you feel better. And you're like so relieved that you're literally jumping. And you know, that's what life's a bit like. You have to go through these dark things, and then there's a point where you sit there and go, oh, I get what that was about.
But a lot of people, I mean, I'm doing as much work as I possibly can at the moment about loneliness. We need to do something about tackling loneliness. It's at epidemic proportions, and the rates of suicide are going up in young people due to loneliness, and it's this taboo. But a lot of people still don't like to say that they've got problems in their head.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't like to say, I'm lonely. A lot of people don't want to say, I'm shy. I mean, you and I have talked about shyness endlessly because I was that painfully shy teenager, and I still get moments of excruciating shyness, and I'm very open about it. But people feel that no matter any of these things, you still shouldn't talk about it. And you've worked so hard and your books are fantastic. And there are a lot of people who are being outspoken and talking about these things. And yet we're still being judged too much. Everyone is hypercritical.
Oh, yeah. But society is hypercritical. And I think the place I've come to on that is that if someone's judging you, it says more about them than it does about
you. Absolutely.
So because I now realise if I start to judge someone, I absolutely have to pull back and go, what is it in this person that is triggering me? Because it's not about them. It's solely about me. Because actually, it's none of my bloody business what anyone else does.
Yes.
You know, and I see this. I see this when I write pieces and there are people go into the comments and go, and they just start abusing you and saying this is drivelled. And I thought, why don't you go and read something? Why are you spending your time getting this het up about something you don't like when this is a news website with literally thousands of other pieces that you could read?
Do you think it's purely? I mean, I think it's about them, but that is so Madonna. You think? Look at Madonna. Everybody has an opinion on Madonna, how she looks. Mm-hmm. Let's just put it down to that. It's none of our business.
No.
I had this conversation with somebody this weekend who was spouting about Madonna. And I said, does it matter? She's Madonna. It doesn't matter. And if somebody down the street did that, it doesn't matter. Would you go up to them and say something? Well, no, but she shouldn't have...
No, why shouldn't she? Why do you think that she shouldn't?
Exactly.
Because that's the question. And it's always triggering something in another person. That's the issue. And sadly, people don't realise it. So, yeah, but we do live in a judgy society. But I do think when it comes to mental health issues, actually, the people who are the most judgmental are ourselves, on ourselves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think one of the... You know, I always think the thing about mental illness that all mental illnesses have in common is that they work by lying to you, and they tell you that you're a freak, and they tell you that you're alone, and they tell you that no one's going to understand what you're going through. And that's just bollocks, you know, but it's a very difficult thing not to believe when you're in it. And so one of the symptoms of most mental illnesses is stigmatizing themselves. They almost tell you that you don't have them.
Did you tell yourself you didn't have it?
I definitely went to this place of like, you've spoken about your mental illness, Bryony. You've written books about it. You've been really honest about it. So this can't be happening to you now. Like, enough. We've had enough of hearing about your mental health issues. And I remember someone saying to me, oh, the thing about mental health issues is they're not like mobile data. There's not a cap on them, you know. And I was like, oh, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes we have to recover from something more than once before we're properly healed, you know. I definitely had that sort of, oh, this isn't, I want to present this kind of, I think we want to have, you know, we need narratives, don't we, in life? We want things to have happy beginnings and middles and ends, and
yes,
someone to kind of face their demons and triumph over adversity and walk off into the sunset and live happily ever after.
Life isn't a movie.
No, life is tragically not a movie. And so that's what I'm trying to do in my books, is go, oh, you know, it's a bit messy. It's a bit, you know, back and forth, but it's okay. Like, if this is you, it's okay.
Do you feel the weight of responsibility on your shoulders, though, as well? Because you do help an incredible amount of people.
No, not anymore. I did. But I realised my job is literally just, I talk to myself. This is what I say to myself. It's like, Bryony, you put down what you've gone through on paper. Do you know what I mean? And you be honest about that. And that is your only job. You know, and then try and signpost to places where people can, you know, find help if they've gone through that. My job is to say, I feel like what I do is I'm like, I'm going to write this book because I've heard other people have these things that I have, but no one really talks to me about them or admits to it. So if I write this book, why don't we all congregate around this book if you've got this thing, instead of staying at home by ourselves thinking we're freaks, and we can realise together, congregating around this book, that we're not freaks. You know, we're not mad, or we are mad, but we're not bad. that's basically my job. And then after that, I can't, it's not, you know, like I'm not saving people's lives here. Do you know what I mean? But people save their own life. You know, people do it themselves.
But you're helping people to do it for themselves.
Yeah, but there are things that I read over the years that helped me and nudged me, you know, but there's lots of things. There's lots of things in the, you know, there's lots of reasons people kind of choose to get well instead of, you know, tragic other options. Mm. And we're not in control. I can't control anything. No, I can't even really control myself, as my books have shown time and time again, you know. So I kind of, yeah, I try to kind of right-size that a bit. It's important I do, because otherwise the OCD comes in and is like, you're harming people with what you do.
No.
But that's where I have to be quite careful.
Yes, of course.
Like, I'm just telling my story, and if it helps you, great.
And it's fantastic that you've helped so many people. And the doubters and the people who don't want to say, as you say, it's about them. It's not about what you've done. When you started writing all those years ago, did you ever think you would get to did you ever see further than each moment? So you never did?
No. There was no plan. Mm. There was no plan.
But you wanted to write.
Oh, yeah. But I didn't know that I wanted to write. You know, I loved, you know, journalism. I was fascinated in newspapers and stuff like that. But there was certainly no plan to write about mental illness. I mean, I don't think I was even aware I had mental illness until quite a long time into my career. Do you know what I mean? Again, I just thought I was a freak, you know, and wrong and faulty. I didn't.
It's so awful that you feel like that. That anyone feels like that. No, I don't mean you. I just think it's just so sad. To put it into simple terms, it's very sad that anybody would sit there on their own and say, I'm a freak, I'm not good, nobody likes me.
But I don't think it's even that, like, conscious. You know, I think these are things that just run around in people's heads all day without them even realising they are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, like, I wasn't sitting at home going, God, I'm a freak, and I'm a da-da-da. You know, I was just like, oh, you know, feeling just...
You had a... It was a feeling.
A feeling, yeah. It's not a conversation you're necessarily having with yourself. I think now I am, you know, in a way... Life is just this kind of journey of becoming more conscious of that feeling and sort of going, well, feelings aren't facts, or what's the phrase? You know, like, it's okay, you know, and stepping back from it.
But it's okay to feel. I mean, that's another thing that we all, as you said, we're not taught that you can be sad. I think in schools, and I think they're getting closer to that now, maybe, hopefully, in some schools, but you can feel. You are allowed to feel.
Feelings, not failings.
Yeah.
But also, I think we want this, we've had this notion of we want to protect our children from mental health stuff. We want to protect our children from feeling bad. And that's just not helpful. It's not helpful. You cannot protect your child from feeling bad. You can't.
And it's that thing about falling over. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
If your child falls over, go, oh no, they've fallen. They've got to. Yeah. Okay, they've fallen over. They're going to get up.
Yeah.
They are going
to. That's the thing. Yeah. And I think that's where still, and I can totally get it, parents think, oh, my child is, you know, lots of people come to me and go, my child has OCD. I just feel terrible. And you want to go, stop, you know, you're getting help for it now for the child. Mm. Like, that's brilliant. So this hopefully won't get baked in over many years as it did with me. And it's okay. Like, brains misfire like any other organ, you know. But also, I think that I've come to the place where I really think that mental health issues are kind of your brain's very sophisticated, clever way of telling you that something isn't right in your environment. And, you know, for a kid, that doesn't have to be that your parents are, you know, abusing you, you know, or, you know, something terrible. It could just be stress of going to secondary school. You know, that's a big deal, you know, coupled with hormones all over the place.
And exams, too many exams.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other story.
You know, that's, and that your child is sensitive and they, you know, and that is okay. You know, instead of going, oh, I want you to be this way, it's like, no, you have a child that's that way and that's okay. And it's not a failing and it's not very, it's not nice to have OCD. You know, it's not nice, but these are sort of weird brain glitches that affect people in the same way people get. I don't know.
But like, it's their story. This is part of their story. A dear friend of mine, who you also know, but a dear friend of mine once said years ago, you can't, they were talking about their child and they were saying something their child was doing. I said, oh, that's incredible. They said, yeah, this is their story. This is part of their life. I'm not going to go and I'm going to help and I'm going to guide and I'll get help for them. But this is their story. And it was just such a wonderful way of looking at it.
Well, because I do think we tend to think of parenting as like, you know, we talk about mini me.
Oh, I can't bear that.
And, you know, that sort of tiger parenting of wanting the best for them, when really a lot of the time it's actually what, you know, children as sort of extensions of yourself. I don't know. Like, I wouldn't say, that sounds quite judgy in itself, but, you know, sometimes you have to question, like, well, you know, obviously,
is it for you or for the child?
Yeah. Or is this really helping the child? Or is this just some expectation that society has put on us that we think the child should do? And like, I see my job as a parent isn't to kind of like guide my daughter to Harvard University or, you know, I don't know, you know, to sort of this, you know, this kind of, or to become a doctor or a nuclear physicist or whatever. My job as a parent is to kind of be there alongside her and hold her through all of the things and give her advice she won't listen to.
No, of course, you know, she won't. She's a girl. You're a mum.
And tell her, you know, and it's my job to tell her when I think she's behaving in a way that is going to harm her out there. Do you know what I mean? But I can't, you know, it's not, I don't know, it's...
She's only little. You wait till teenage years.
No, I mean, she's about to be 11.
Yeah, about to head in there.
It's the tween age.
Yeah.
So, like, her hormones are on the up while mine are on the down. And my husband's in the between going, oh, my God.
Yeah, welcome to my world. Yeah, exactly. When the girls were both teenagers and I was reaching menopause, it was, you can imagine, it was like, what is going on in the house? But actually, do you know, the lovely thing is they come back again. So they go through those years and they come back again.
I love seeing my daughter, you know, you can really see the last year of primary school, the kids that are starting to kind of, they're a bit cool and they've got phones. And my daughter doesn't have a phone and I won't have a phone until she, I don't know.
She's 87.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically. But she's, and she had, so there's some that are really cool and they're like, oh yeah, boys, or, you know, whatever. And then there's others that and this weekend she had two friends to come and stay for a sleepover and it was so adorable. They were playing like hide and seek.
Good.
And I was,
love that.
I was just so delighted to see these 10-year-olds who are kind of on the brink of, well, they're going to go to secondary school this year. It was so adorable.
So she was 6, 7 at the beginning of the pandemic. Mm. So you talk about
the
pandemic and the, you mentioned it already and you'll talk about it in the book, but also for your daughter. I mean, that time for anybody with mental health issues, it exacerbated everything.
It did, but the problem...
There was a comfort in it as well, wasn't there?
Well, I think the interesting thing was... Yes, it exacerbated everything. But because we were dealing with, you know, a terrible, terrible illness that, you know, there were people lying face down in intensive care units, you know, and it was, I think it was kind of almost catnip for that thing, that sort of reflex of depression or whatever to go, you think you've got problems, like, you know, you're not, you know, it was like, you've got your health, so, you know, you've got your physical health, so just shut up and stop moaning. And I did a lot of like gaslighting myself, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I remember just feeling I beating myself up because I wasn't enjoying being locked in my house all day and I wanted And I was like, why can't you just do this thing? Like, all you're doing is being asked to sit on your sofa and watch Ant and Dec Saturday Night Takeaway. Like, this is not the fucking Blitz, Bryony. You know, that was my brain. Like, and you'd go on Twitter or whatever, and people would be kind of, and people I really respected would be shaming someone who had sat, they'd seen sitting down on a bench or runners, and how selfish they were, and how this was a, and I was like, oh, I'm selfish. I'm a thoughtless person because I'm thinking about my mental health or how sad I am or how anxious I am. And there are people out there dying. Like, fucking buck up, Bryony. So I think there was a lot, probably a lot of that for people. There was also, I think a lot of people, initially, when the lockdowns were announced, I was quite relieved because A, I was like, I told you the world was ending. I've been telling you this since I was 12. now you can see. But also because I could get off the rat, you know, get off the hamster wheel of life.
I know a lot of people who felt that.
Yeah.
So but I now don't have to fight anymore.
But I realise that the bit of me that was really relieved was kind of all my mental, like the Jareth the Goblin King, as I call all my sort of OCD and alcoholism. And, you know, because it's like, ooh, we can get you isolated at home. And all those things that you think you hate doing, like having to get the train or the tube or whatever, or going to meetings in town or small talk at the school gates. And you're like, oh, God, these just drive me up the wall. And you're like, no, these are the things that actually anchor you in your day and keep you sane. Because you do these little tiny hard things every day that you think you can't and you don't want to do. But you're like, OK, I'm going to do it. And then you get home at the end of the day and go, huh. I did, look, I can do hard things, even if that hard, you know, that hard thing might not be climbing Everest. But to me, sometimes having to make small talk at the school gate is like climbing Everest, or pushing myself out and turning up at all of the appointments I have in my diary for that day. Like, for me, every day I wake up and my brain is like, nope, do not want to do today. How can we get out of everything today? How can we do it? Let's just hide here in terror, right? And I have to circumvent that as quickly as possible. But sometimes to do that, and I think this is the thing of, I have to put on like hundreds of masks just to get myself up and out of the house, you know? And I think that's the kind of person I'm writing these books for, is we have this notion of mental illness as someone like rocking back and forth in a padded cell. And it is that, you know, but it isn't just that. And these books are for the people who every day have to get up. They don't fucking want to, but they have to, you know. And like plaster on a smile, pretend everything is fine, you know, and hold it together. Because if they don't hold it together, everything is falling apart. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And if they do, you know, so yeah.
That's why I'm going back to, you do help a lot of people. And it's, and that's why I'm pleased when you said you don't feel that weight on your shoulders, because you do. And you also have a lot of people's ears. I mean, we've got mutual friends that we won't name, but you have a lot of people's ears. And that must be a wonderful thing. A really wonderful thing to know that these people trust you, and trust is such a beautiful thing for somebody to hand over.
Yeah, I think there are people that I have built. Yeah, I certainly, as a journalist, you know, I still write for a newspaper, and I realised I was like, I don't want to be getting stories from people by having to kind of screw them over. That's
good.
Not how I...
Hallelujah.
And I, very early on, had that sort of don't want to do this. When I was like 21, I had a brief time working at the Mirror as a 3 a.m. girl, and I hated it, and I quit after 3 months. And I was like, if this is what I have to do to be a journalist, I don't want to be a journalist. And I...
They have a bad rap. You know, they really do, journalists.
Yeah, no, they do, but they don't, you know, like there's a lot of really very good journalists.
Yeah.
And I think that I really came into my own in journalism after, you know, a couple of decades, when I started talking about my own stuff and people trusted me enough to be able to tell me about their stuff. And no, they told me more because they knew I wasn't going to like use that information against them, you know.
That's what I mean. It's a wonderful... I hope you keep that close to your heart, that these people trust you and you don't discuss what they say to you and you don't put it in print, and what you do write about them is honest but warm, and you have a real power of writing so warmly about people and caring, and that's such a gift.
Well, thanks, Gabby. Yeah,
but I hope you carry that with you. I hope you know that.
I do sometimes, but sometimes, you know, the voice is going, nah, 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 yeah, rabbit. That was just another, like, barrage of sounds there.
Yeah.
You know. But, yeah, I do. But it's, you know, all of these industries that we work in are quite cutthroat, right? And I don't know. The older I get, the more I'm like, I don't want to... How do I say this? Like, I don't want to have to judge my worth as a human being by your metrics or by how many celebs I've got to open up to me about, like, dark things in their lives. Yeah. Like, if it happens, that's, you know, because they want to talk about stuff to help people on a wider campaigning basis, that's great. But I'm very aware that I'm as good as my latest, you know, like, I like to think that people really care in this industry about mental health campaigning and all of this stuff. But I know they only care about it as long as it's making them money. Does that make sense? And so, like, I've realized that over the last 10 years when I've been writing about mental illness. So I don't, like, you know, so I'm a bit like... I'm not your fair weather friend here. This is really important shit. But if you, and I'll play the game a bit, and do you know what I mean? But if you, not you, Gabby, but if, like, I don't know, I sometimes think to myself, how much do I want to be part of this?
Yeah.
This
yeah.
kind of, like, I think, I'm not sure if I'm making any sense.
No, you
here.
Are. I know. I get you.
But I think we are all coming to the realization that a lot of this sort of rise in mental illness or unhappiness or whatever you want to call it, and we talk a lot about lack of mental health provision on the NHS, and I've sort of come to the conclusion that it wouldn't matter. I mean, the government, you know, don't give a shit about mental health provision. They've shown that very clearly by throwing out the changes to the mental health reform to the Mental Health Act in the last, anyway, I'm babbling, but, you know, they just didn't bother with it, even though they said they would. But I'm also now of the opinion that I think to myself, oh, you know what, they could turn around tomorrow and say, we're going to give 10 billion quid just to mental health services in the NHS. And I don't know that it would make a difference, because it doesn't matter how much money you give, like, you pump into... Because it's you know, it's this into a system. It's the system itself that is the problem, you know. It's the way we live our lives and the things that we prioritise and are taught that we should prioritise. You know, I saw this today. Probably the biggest newspaper in the country, and their front page was something like Generation Sick Note. And it was about how many young people are not working because of mental ill health, and how now people prioritise their mental health over the economy. And I read it and thought, well, I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, maybe that's a good thing. You know, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
I saw the headline myself, and it was the lead story on the news today. Yeah.
And so I think lots of people are going, oh, you know, I could throw myself into this. I can keep going, and I can. So, yeah, I don't. I mean, I've gone off on one now, but I.
But that's what we love about you, Bryony, that you do, and that you speak your mind, and that you're a rare beast. Most people don't do that because they are terrified of how they'll be perceived. Now, interestingly, you want to be perceived, you know, just as you and I've spoken away from here as well, everybody wants to be liked.
Of course.
But you say those things that so many other people wish they could. I think a long time ago I said to you that you're like you're like everybody's dream ventriloquist dummy, that you, because you say all the things that without us putting our hand up your back, that you say those things that people wish they could say. Because there are lots of people out there, when they read your books, they'll say, that's me, that's me.
But that's why I write the books.
That's
because
fantastic.
I'm like, because for some weird reason, Gabby, I don't feel any shame writing this stuff down. In fact, I shed my shame writing this stuff down, right?
And yes!
And so for that reason, I'm like, I feel like it's my duty to write about this stuff, because I know there are people out there who do feel shame but have gone through exactly the same things as me. And so once I'm out the other side, I'm like, oh my God, the thought of one woman sitting alone right now feeling like a freak, I'm like, I can't bear it. You know, like that's what
we're using for our Instagram page. That's it, because every woman, and in fact every man, is just going to go yes, because it's, you know, these books are for men as well.
But it's such a waste of our energy, isn't it? Our precious energy. Like, I think to myself about like our darling Debs, you know,
yeah,
who died coming up for two years ago now. And I think to myself, I do think quite often, and maybe I should get this like tattooed on me, like, what would Debs do?
Yeah.
Debs would not, you know, like, fucking hell, like, the energy that we waste, or that society expects us to waste, hating on ourselves, you know, is tragic, because life is short and it's not a fucking dress rehearsal.
No, it really isn't. And life is so precious. And recently I was went for a walk with another mutual friend, and went for a walk and I just started dancing, and this woman came up to me. She said, can I dance with you? So we danced together. She said, put it on your socials. And she said to me afterwards that she was very ill and she didn't have long to live and she really wanted to do it. And so I just talked to her. She said, oh, you didn't do the sideways head tilt. I said, no, you're alive. She went, yes, I'm alive. I'm not dying. I'm alive right now. Mm. I'm alive. And it was heartbreaking. Of course, I said to her, that's heartbreaking, but how wonderful you're living.
Yeah.
And that's how Debs was. It was, I right now, I'm not, she's always, as you know, never said I'm terminally ill.
No.
I am. Today I'm alive. So I'm going to do that. And I wish we could... I mean, I shout from the rooftops about that. I really do. And I will shout from the rooftops until the day I die that we are so lucky and we've got to make the most of each moment. Because, as you say, this is not a dress rehearsal.
It's not a dress rehearsal. And, you know, I think about Debs and how, like, right to the end, so kind. And I remember, yeah, that I was having a terrible, that, you know, what I'd written about in there about, you know, episode of OCD, and at the beginning of 2022, and I mean, she was, you know,
we're talking about Bowel Babe, by the way. This is Deborah James. So,
and
yeah.
But like that thing of, I remember I was stuck on the sofa because I was like, I can't move. I'm the worst person in the world, and she was stuck on the sofa because she was dying of bowel cancer. You know, but I just always remember texting each other and sending each other's like pictures of what we were looking at from our sofa and all of that thing, and how wonderful she was and how understanding and thoughtful. And, you know, I feel so lucky. I feel so lucky because of her, you know, and like, I feel so lucky to have got to be part of her life, you know.
Mm-hmm. She was an extraordinary, extraordinary woman. And she made a massive difference, because now everybody talks about bowel cancer. Because of you, people talk about mental health. Because of, you know, the more that people talk about these things, they, but you know, that you take the taboo away.
Yeah, I always remember in the, when she'd launched the Bowel Babe Fund, you know, which I was just incredible, you know, the amount of money that she raised.
Oh my God.
But I always remember, had the Today programme on, and I remember hearing Nick Robinson saying, and now we, you know, we need to check our poo. And I thought, yes, Debs!
Yes. So true. Years ago, when my dad had bowel cancer, they interviewed him. It's 28 years ago. And they interviewed him on the ITV News and me. They interviewed two, because Dad wanted everybody to talk about it. And so they interviewed us. And so Dad said, poo and bottom and bum and all that. And they said, can you actually talk about it without mentioning bowel or poo or everything? And my dad just looked at them and said, no, it's about your poo.
Yeah.
And they said, No, sorry, you're a newsreader. You know that we can't use that word. So my dad just sat there and went, poo, 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 bum, bum, bum.
And did they allow it on?
No, they changed the thing to bowel cancer, colon cancer, that was it. But that's how it's changed. Look, Deb's made it, everybody now talks about their poo.
Yeah, yeah.
She's going to be laughing now, going, I cannot believe you're saying, yeah, because of me, everyone's talking about poo.
Everyone's going to say bum and poo.
Yeah. Good for you, Deb. Bloody hell. Oh, we miss you. Amazing lady. Thank you for being on this. Congratulations on the next book, because you will be doing another one.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm
saying congratulations because you can't, you actually can't stop doing these. And also, Mad Woman is, they all follow, it's a weird thing to say. This is really weird. Okay, I'm going to say it. But they follow on so beautifully from each other. And I feel like we all get to know you a bit more, but get to know ourselves a bit more.
Oh, thank you.
So you very kindly sent me a copy. I've now given it to four of my friends.
Oh, wow.
No, I have. And a friend of mine is going through lots of stuff. And I gave it to her. And then she talked about it. So I went to, I bought it for three others. And
thank you.
But one of them, her husband, said it's been the most fantastic guide for him to know about her.
Really?
Yeah.
I just, do you know what? It's so beautiful. It doesn't, obviously, doesn't make me happy to know other people have gone through but it makes me feel, I look back and I want to take Bryony 2 or 3 years ago and go, look, you see, like, other people are going through this stuff and this will be worth it one day because you'll write about it and it will help other people. And you'll turn the dark into light, babes. So don't just hold on, hang on in there, because you don't know what is around the corner. And it's true.
You bring the light.
You bring the light?
No, you bring the light.
No, you bring the light. No, you do.
Bryony.